You're listening to Wins Above Fantasy, part of the Pitcherless Podcast Network with Van Burnett and Steve Gisuelli.
Welcome back, everybody. It is Wins Above Fantasy, episode 163. I'm Van Burnett, joined as always by Steve Gisuelli. Today is Wednesday, December 11th. If you're joining on the stream, if you're joining on the podcast, happy Thursday, happy off season, and happy draft season, I believe, to you, Steve, as you have broken the seal on your first draft. But we'll have plenty of shows throughout the offseason to talk about some of our draft recaps. We have a very exciting show tonight with a special guest, one that has been kind of a founding father in the fantasy baseball and podcast industry, and one that Steve and I have both followed and listened to for a long time. Spoiler alert, unless you're already seeing the show title. But first, I got to tease it a little bit. And it has to be addressed, Steve, that for the second time in our five-year podcast history, we had an in-person run-in last week, spontaneous trip for me from Central Illinois out to New York City to catch a show. It was a birthday Christmas gift for my wife, and got to crash at the podcast studio of Steve Gisuelli. So it was a larger-than-life moment, and I just had to officially cite on the air how grateful I am for that. You guys are fantastic hosts. How are you doing before we introduce our guest of honor tonight?
It was great, and it was great seeing you. And it's funny. I mean, we talked about it when this show was like 15 episodes old. Now we're 163 into it, which is crazy to say. But the only two times I've seen you was at my wedding, which was another spontaneous trip. And then last weekend, on 12 hours notice of you crashing at my place for a trip to New York City. But it was great seeing you and hosting you, and it was short but sweet, and I'm glad we got to do it. I mean, we talked about it. We spent countless hours talking baseball together. It's just we've spent probably 2 hours in person together over these last 5 years, but it was great to have you nonetheless.
It was fun. I got to sit in the seat of Steve Gisuelli that I look at for over a week of my calendar life. So that was great, and a special thanks to the kind people out there that reached out after our Thanksgiving episode as well. Your comments made our days, our weeks. But without further ado, we have to introduce the esteemed guest from CBS, who you guys can find on Twitter and Blue Sky at CP Towers. Chris Towers, welcome to the podcast. Like I said, I have long since been a listener and a follower of your work. I feel like you are the everyman and the comic relief, and you bring great expertise as well. So it is awesome having you on. We've chatted with Scott in the past, with Frank in the past, and it's awesome to kind of have the trio. Yeah. How's it going? Welcome to the show.
I appreciate the like sense of humor being listed ahead of the expertise, because I feel like that is what I'm going for. Like, you know, Frank and Scott, they're brilliant, and like, I'm mostly just trying to keep up, so I got to just throw in my dumb jokes and like weird references that Scott and Frank don't get. That's kind of what I bring to the table, I think.
And the filmography. I mean, the great taste in movies as well. So,
well,
yeah.
Especially, like, you know, no offense to Frank and Scott. I love them, but they are not the most cultured people in the world.
You bring the cultured vibe.
There's a lot of references that I'll drop on the show, and I just get a complete blank stare back at me. So I'm glad there are people out there who appreciate it.
Very much so. And the reason I mentioned the humor out of the gate is I do feel like when you guys are bantering, oftentimes, occasionally at Scott's, you know, defense, your kind of silent laugh, like the wheeze laugh, has made me laugh out loud so many times in my car. So it is awesome having you on. Thank you for giving us some time. We are going to be talking about position previews, which is what you've been dropping some awesome articles throughout the off season. And like you were saying before the show, you've been able to fully dedicate to baseball. I got to hear you as well on the Arizona Fall League episode that Nick did, the live in-person one. But wanted to welcome you, Steve. I'll allow you as well to welcome Chris to the show here. I don't know if you want to start off with any big picture questions before we jump into all of the positions, which should be a fun, fast and furious show.
No, yeah, I do want to get into it. It's going to be a jam-packed rundown, and it's the idea was inspired by your off season, or like it seemed, I think it was like the first project that you dived into in the off season, right, Chris? Like sort of right as the playoffs were going on, I think, right? You started doing this, yeah.
My main thing along with the podcast is the Fantasy Baseball Today newsletter, and we've been going pretty steady twice a week throughout the off season, which is a nice change of pace because we do it 5 days a week during the season. Yeah. That is a one, I write way too much for it, and I'll do like a random Thursday, and I'll like wake up out of a trance at 1 a.m. and I've written 3,000 words. So like this is a nice change of pace. I can breathe a little bit. Not you know, all my fantasy football teams are terrible now that I'm not writing about it. That's fine. And yeah, this was I finished it a couple of weeks ago, right before the you know, the off season really began, and yeah, looking forward to talking about it. We've got a little bit settled at a couple of positions, but there's still obviously quite a lot to go.
Well, where can you find that newsletter, just to plug it so that people listening can follow it and sign up for it, as we recommend that you do?
It's in my bios on all the social medias, but also cbssports.com/newsletters, and it'll be one of the, I don't know, 7 or 8 that you can choose from there. And yeah, choose the Fantasy Baseball Today newsletter. It's free, so
can't beat that.
You know, love it.
Literally no cost except me annoying you in your inbox every morning for 8 months.
Yeah, it is great stuff, and I think most are listening to you guys on a regular basis as well, which is awesome. But like we said, we got a packed rundown, and like you did with your article series, I think we'll fire it up with catcher, get it out of the way, as you've addressed. And loved kind of the lead in on this, that, you know, every year we kind of convince ourselves that maybe this is the year that catcher will not stink. I know you made the comparison as well to the football tight ends, and this is the last we'll address football, but I'm always the guy getting burnt on like the bad year for a George Kittle. And sometimes I've done it with catcher as well, where I'm like, oh, maybe Evan Gaddis will save my fantasy season. You know, like there's a name
there
from the past.
There was a year where Evan Gaddis probably saved your, maybe two.
Yeah,
that year
I
he had like
14
triples, right? Yeah, that was weird.
I think I was in the year after I changed my avatar to a picture of him, and it all backfired. But Chris, talk to me on the outset about the catcher landscape. I know we kind of already addressed, but how would you kind of prescribe listeners to approach the catcher position this year?
Yeah, look, I like I said, that you can talk yourself into every, and I remember last year we did a lot of podcasts talking about, like, you know, you look at the young guys, and Josh Naylor and Gabriel Moreno had that second half power surge, and he had a good playoffs, and, you know, Keibert Ruiz, and it never really works. And it's natural, right? Like you look at one, like let's talk about the trade that happened today as we're talking on Thursday, Kyle Teal going to the White Sox. And it's like, I've seen a lot of like, why would they trade for Kyle Teal when they have Edgar Cuero? And it's like, well, it's like pitching. You can't actually have too many catchers because the attrition rate is so high. And especially for prospects, you know, you think about some of the high end prospects in the last, let's say, half decade, just to keep it there. I mean, you know, Joey Bart was supposed to be a star, and Henry Davis, ironically, both of them on the same team now. It's very similar profiles. And, you know, it just because every position requires a lot of work on defense. But I don't think it's unfair to say that catcher is the most difficult, because you're not just learning the actual physical part of the game, which is incredibly difficult at the catcher position, probably, you know, more difficult than any other position to learn the you know, intricacies of it, but also just the pounding that you take. And not just that, but then, you know, even with PitchCom, you know, you still have to be able to call a game. Like, teams still want you to be able to do that, ideally. Not every catcher does it, but like the really good ones are still doing it. And so, you know, you add all the things that go into it, and I think the reason the tight end comp works so well is because that's another one where tight ends are kind of learning multiple positions at the NFL. You got to be able to, I mean, you don't have to be able to block, but it helps. You're going to be asked to block occasionally unless you're Kyle Pitts. You're learning, you know, you're working with the receivers. You got it. So there's so much that goes into it. And that's why, like, I'm not the biggest Kyle Teal fan. I don't know if Edgar Cuero will actually be able to play another position or at least hit enough to do it. But like, I don't think there will ever be a point where the White Sox are like, boy, I wish we didn't have two good catchers. Like, if it works out that way, great, I think. So that's the thing about this position is just the it's like the old joke. The meal was bad and the portions were so small. You know, like that's the way catcher works is like the peaks aren't very high and they tend to be really short. Guys tend to fall off really quickly. So a good catcher in their 30s is pretty rare at this point. So
yeah,
a lot of things come into go into play there.
Yeah, you bring up that great point that it's kind of like they're late to start. And to your point, it's like they're double majoring in multiple skill sets. So the development takes a while and then the cliff comes soon to where, you know, guys who are past age 30, so, you know, you mentioned Will Smith starts to fall off and it happens pretty fast. Mm-hmm. Steve, given the landscape, talk about kind of your thought on approaching catcher, because with all that comes the tax, right? And you look at somebody who's like a William Contreras who has a $10 auction value jump from him being the number one catcher to the number two catcher on like projections, auction calculators, where it's Sal Perez who seems to be defying Father Time a little bit. But you got to pay up for those guys. Contreras' ADP is a top 30 player overall. Then there's a big gap. How do you plan to kind of approach catcher this year?
I think it's probably the hardest position to solve, at least hitter-wise, for fantasy. I 100% was that guy last year that was like, oh, wow, look at all these good catchers. And a lot of that was because I really thought that, like, Francisco Alvarez was going to take that step last year, and I had him on a ton of teams, and he was, like, the 12th or 13th catcher overall. It's like, wow, if he's the 12th best catcher, there's got to be other really good ones above him. And that was not really the case, and it's really not the case. There's just so many things, like you said, that go against catchers in the real game that hurts them in fantasy. They don't play every day. You know, they're a position that defense is focused on and super important in the real life game, and not only like the fielding aspect of it and the framing aspect, but calling a game. There's so many other things that don't translate to the fantasy game that have priorities in the real game that make it difficult. That being said, the way at least we play in NFBC, it's two catchers, so it's super important to like it's not the way I would make the game if I were making up the rules, but that's the way that we play in our high stake leagues and our industry leagues. So it is an important position. It's a hard position. And even in like my home league team and like daily leagues with daily moves, there's a standard, you know, Yahoo or CBS or, you know, your leagues on Fantrax where there's one catcher or daily moves. Like my friends and I joke about it, like being on the catcher carousel and like adding a catcher every week or if you have limited ads is the worst feeling in the world. Like, even though it's not as many at bats, just you're plugging in a zero to your lineup and it's so frustrating.
It is like, I think I would rather be there than like, I don't know.
Paying up
for like
Cal Raleigh.
No, like, oh, yeah, no, yeah. I mean like, cause there are the guys who like Cal Raleigh, the batting average stinks, but like you would use him at a different position. If he wasn't catcher eligible, like
you wouldn't think about adding a catcher if you had Cal Riley as your catcher.
Whereas like, I think the worst place you can be is with like a truly mediocre catcher who's good enough that you don't think about it, because then that's where I think it's actually the treadmill of mediocrity where like, I don't know, Keibert Ruiz, like he's fine, I guess, or Gabriel Moreno or David Fry last year. Like, these guys are fine. They'll finish as top 15 catchers, but throughout the course of the year, you know, you think about, like, Shea Langelier's emergence. Mm-hmm. He probably wasn't drafted in a lot of leagues last year, or Logan Ohapi was probably a low-end catcher, dart, too, if he was drafted, or
Jonah Heim of years past.
Jonah Heim the year before, yeah. Like, that's where you kind of – I almost think there's value in going in – because look, your team's going to have flaws somewhere. This is just unless you are the best drafter ever and you have a real and you just run I don't know, sevens all the way across the board. I don't actually know craps, but I think seven is what you're trying to get. You're going to have a hole somewhere on your team. And I think because of the volatility and the attrition of the catcher and starting pitcher positions, I think you can make a case that, like, knowing that you're weak there is actually a benefit to a certain extent in the season, because now you know your what your focus needs to be when you're running fab, where, like, if you just kind of have, like, decent guys, you can that might be an easy way to end up in sixth place, you know?
Mm-hmm. You're more likely to add the Shea Langeliers if you're like, oh, yeah, wow, this catcher just hit three homers in a game. Like, sure, why not? Let's ride it. And then,
and like, look, that can go wrong because,
yeah, of course, yeah,
Ben Rice had two good weeks, yeah, and was pretty, yeah, dreadful after that.
That's a sensitive topic for Ben there. Yeah.
So it can be like, you know, but like, you know, Joey Bart and Austin Wells had really long stretches where they were useful, yeah, last season. And I almost think you do have to go like either like Wilson Contreras or William Contreras, excuse me, would be a legitimate starter. Like, he's mm-hmm. probably a top 10 first baseman if he's just first base eligible. And so mm-hmm. that edge that you can get, I mean, you're talking like, I don't know, a 10 homer, 30 run, 30 RBI edge on most catchers that people are starting.
It's a huge advantage.
That's really significant. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think if you're in, you won't get away with it in industry leagues, but if you're in a home league where a player like that slides, I agree. I think that's mm-hmm. a name that jumps out. Any other names, you know, sans the punt strategy where we're voluntarily doing the catcher carousel. Mm-hmm. Is there another name? I feel like Adley Rutschman is one that we've kind of flagged as like maybe the price is suppressed because of what presumably is an injury. Chris, mm-hmm. are you interested in Adley or anybody else in kind of that investment level of like a top 100 ADP, which would be kind of Shangaliers up to William Contreras? Will you have any shares of any of those guys?
Wilson Contreras has pushed into that top 100, and I think he is one of those guys because one of the real edges that you can get at the position is through these guys who are catchers but don't play catcher. Mm-hmm. That's actually a huge edge because you're not just avoiding like the attrition of the position. Wilson Contreras, a good example of that. Last year, the Cardinals wanted him to become a better framer. He's setting up closer to the batter, fractured his arm as a result because he got hit by a swing. So, like, that was a freak injury. I don't expect that to happen. Now that he's playing first base, like, there are other injury risks, but I think on the whole, it's not outrageous to say the first basemen get hurt less than catchers. So I think that mm-hmm. is a big, big edge for Wilson Contreras to the point where, you know, he's the number seven catcher in ADP. I think you can make the case for Wilson Contreras being as high as five, depending on how you feel about, you know, Will Smith and the kind of mess season he had. And even like Salvador Perez, he's old. Is he going to get to play as much first base as he did down the stretch last year? You know, I would still rather have those guys than Wilson Contreras, but I think you can make the case for it.
Yeah, and the ADP helps the case big time. So let's talk about first base and keep rolling here because it is a position that, to your point, you would think William Contreras would have easily cracked that. That doesn't mean quite as much as it used to because first base is usually such a deep well of power and, you know, overall just contribution to your fantasy lineup. And last year we saw a pretty big drop-off in terms of power, but also in terms of overall production. And you look at, you know, some of the names, Steve and I have long been of the book, Chris, that we try to get like a top four guy, you know, mm-hmm. in the first three or four rounds before it drops off and you can't expect 30 to 35 homers with a 275 average and up. And last year it looked like, you know, some of those didn't even pan out as you would want them to. So there were some injuries and suddenly we kind of look at first base and it's almost a position to address, which feels really foreign mm-hmm. to how we've been drafting for as long as fantasy's been around. Talk about big picture, kind of what you see with the first baseman landscape. And then, yeah, we'll talk about some guys and tiers that we like for this one as well.
Yeah, last year was a really bad year for first base. And what we've seen is on the whole, first basemen are just much less productive than they used to be. I looked it up, and all right, so from 2002 to 2023, Fangraphs has data where you can sort what they did at the position. So not just what position they were labeled as, but what they did when they were playing first base. And last year, first basemen collectively had just a 107 weighted runs created plus. That is the worst in the last 23 seasons, and one of only three seasons in that 23-year stretch where a first baseman had worse than a 110 weighted runs created collectively. So I think there are a couple of reasons why. One is just it's been a pretty crummy stretch of first base-only prospects. Andrew Vaughn, Spencer Torkelson, Brendan McKay mm-hmm. was a first baseman.
And we were excited about those names too, yeah, for sure.
Tristan Casas, like I like him, but it hasn't happened yet. You know, we haven't gotten the big season from him yet. So it's just when you look at the big time prospects at first base, they haven't really hit lately. It's kind of been since like Pete Alonso that you had like a big time first baseman who actually hit the ground running, was an impact player immediately and stayed that way. I think the other thing is the universal DH has shifted some of the, like 10 years ago, Kyle Schwarber on the Phillies. I mean, Bryce Harper, I guess now changes that, but like Kyle Schwarber, Marcelo Ozuna, those guys might've been playing first base somewhere rather than being full-time DHs. So I think that's shifted some of the offensive burden away from the first base position. And then there's just been kind of this like changing of the guard where Joey Votto and Paul Goldschmidt and guys like that have faded, but the younger guys haven't stepped up. And I think teams are just a little more likely to just leave. I don't want to say leave a bad defender in a more important defensive position because I think teams care about defense. I think teams are just smarter about shifting and getting the most out of their guys so that like Max Muncy is still not a full-time DH or first baseman. And he's, what, 34, 35? Was never, like, a great player, great defensive player, but he, like, they'll stick him at third base, even a second base occasionally.
Vlad played third this year, and he came up as a third baseman. Like, they were like, all right, we can position you well enough that you don't have to play first base.
And the guy that I think was, like, kind of one of the kind of revolutionizers of this, I guess, is when Mike Moustakas got to the Brewers. They started playing him at second base.
I remember that. And they're like, we're like, what is going on? Like, he's playing like, second base? Like, what?
I can't remember who they had at first at the time, but it was like they signed
Travis
Mike
Shaw, maybe?
Yeah.
Was Shaw third or first? Yeah. I remember that's one that Heath killed me on. He was a Travis Shaw guy.
We loved Travis Shaw. But yeah, that when Mike Moustakas was playing second, I was like, oh, this is like the only time in Major League history that this would happen. Like that guy would have been playing a corner and probably just first base at that point in his career. But because of shifting and how smart teams are about that, it's changed the way first base is so that you don't just stick your best bat at first base anymore. You can get away with it. So that, that does, I think, change has led to some systematic issues at the first base position for fantasy.
Well, and it's an ADP landscape that reflects kind of the philosophy that we've had in the past, Steve, where it's like, okay, we see the value in investing up front. After pick 46, which is Pete Alonso, it's about a 50 pick gap until you get to the next true first baseman and Josh Naylor. So it definitely begs the question of, you know, are you on the bus early on and investing, or are you okay waiting? I mean, maybe it's not as black and white as the catcher position, for instance, on like a philosophy. But Steve, we've been running from that same playbook. Do you feel like you're going to be back in there? And then I definitely want to hear where Chris is at on that question, too.
I think so, especially in leagues where there's corner infield. I know third base, and we'll get to it, is pretty stacked. But first base is much more shallow. I think one other thing, Chris, maybe I just throw this idea off you. I think teams now are willing to platoon at first base, whereas like the old adage was, oh, we need our 150-game first baseman that hits 35 home runs and, you know, is a source of power that we play every day. teams have moved away from that. Like, they're fine to, like, platoon that position or, like, you know, John Birdie played first base for the Yankees in the playoffs. Like, I know that's an extreme example, but, you know, it's not the...
Right, Cronenworth.
Yeah, it's not the amazing source of, like, fantasy stardom that I think it used to be, say, 10, 15 years ago. That said, I want, like, a first baseman by like Christian Walker. Like, I want to leave with a top five first baseman. I feel that way. I don't know if that's maybe too old school or I need to adapt and be okay with taking and treating first base more of like a middle infield position of days past. But just because I want like a superstar first baseman, third baseman, and then like a pretty good corner infielder, that's probably going to be a third baseman. So that's kind of how I know that. I don't like to take pitchers early generally, so that maybe that frees me up a little bit, but I still want to leave my drafts with feeling good about first baseman.
I think
Chris, yeah.
The way I would phrase it is, like, it's got the high end guys. It's got a pretty decent middle class. Like, I like the guys around 180p, Naylor, Tristan Casas, Christian Walker. Less so Spencer Steer. I'm a little iffy on him being a borderline top 100 guy, but like Vinny Pasquantino, I still have high hopes for him.
Can't quit.
Then there's a huge drop where Jake Berger's 127, 125 ish in ADP. And then the next one is Luis Arraez at 186 in ADP. Like, that's a big drop. But then you've got Michael Tolia and Yadi Diaz, Christian Encarnacion Strand, who I like. It's shallow in impact bats. And I think even like Jake Berger's number 12, if we throw Salvador Perez out, I don't really know how I love that. And I think the trade
in Texas makes it
a little iffier, even although it's a much better lineup. So like, I don't know if I don't get one of those like true impact guys. And I think you could probably say like a top eight player at the position. I'm okay waiting. Like, there are enough guys outside of the top 180 in ADP who I can talk myself into, but obviously, look, you're taking on a lot of risk if Michael Toley is your first baseman. You know, like, I think it's an interesting player, but you know, if he hits 30 homers this year, I wouldn't be surprised. If he's in AAA on June 1st, I wouldn't be surprised. So that's where I think the lack of, it's not that there aren't interesting bats, it's just there's a real lack of certainty at first base.
Well, and maybe because of those options at different tiers, it affords you the ability to kind of see how the draft room plays out and what falls to you, how it balances with your team needs. Because I agree. I think in that second wave around pick 100, there's some names that are interesting, but there are some I would like more than others.
Yeah.
And then in the deep section, another one that's new to that tier is Paul Goldschmidt at 190. We'll see where he lands, but
he showed some Brewers, signs of life late.
Yeah, he did. And it was really, rough in the first half. And he did, you know, the plate discipline looked better. The hits or the bat warmed up quite a bit. So yeah, I think it is an area where maybe you can be a little bit more reactionary, but I think, when you look at that top four, I think in Vlad, Bryce Harper, Freddie Freeman, five with Matt Olson and Pete Alonso. That's definitely like the big five to where you'll be have a little bit more peace of mind. So we'll get over to second base, which is another position that we need to plan for, but we're going to take our first ad break. We'll be right back after this. Okay. So second base, it's been the worst position in fantasy in years past. And then it felt like we had kind of a sunshine second base window there for 4 years or something. And now it's back to where you're really kind of looking at ADPs and wondering, like, how much is the tax factoring in here, where, like, you know, a second, third round pick is Ketel Marte, who was a stud last year, but you've got Altuve, Albies at the top that come with their age, injury questions, or even production. And then you look at a guy who was one of the bigger busts last year in Marcus Semien, and he's fifth at the position. So this is one that thins out pretty dang quick. It's still some names that we've seen value from in the past as you get deeper, whether it's Xander Bogaerts, Gleyber Torres, Nico Horner. but none of them come with any degree of confidence. I guess from the landscape perspective, Chris, what are we making of second base? Do you have a firm position on kind of how you want to approach this in drafts this year?
Yeah, I think the one thing you mentioned, the like golden age of second base for fantasy, and I think partially that just overlapped with like Jose Altuve's peak and a couple of guys like that. But I think also the juiced ball era really helped second baseman, because you think like Giancarlo Stanton doesn't really need a juiced ball to hit home runs. The guys who need a juiced ball are a Marcus Semien, who doesn't like Marcus Semien's not hitting 430 foot jacks. You know, he's hitting 370 foot home runs that clear the fence by 6 feet. And he's just doing that 1 year, 45 times. And that is where like those fringy power guys tend to be hurt the most by the lack of a juice ball. You saw something similar in the steroid era. There had never been before like 1994, I think. There had never been a season where four second basemen had 20 plus homers in major league history until the 90s. And then it was like pretty regular from 2014 to 2023. And then now last year, I think there were seven, and two of them are no longer second base eligible. Spencer Steer and Ryan McMahon. Ketel Marte was the only one with more than 25 homers. So that's the change that you've seen at the position, where the juiced ball, I think, has really hurt second base. A lot of speed. You can find some batting average at second base. All around contributors, though, are much harder to find now. And it's an old position at the top. You know, Ketel Marte's, I think, probably the youngest of the high end guys outside of Ozzie Albies. And he's, you know, already in his 30s. Jose Altuve, obviously, is 34, 35. Semien's around the same age. So it's also a position where the bottom might have already fallen out for Marcus Semien. I tend to think not. I tend to think he's a pretty good buy with his ADP crashing, but you can see fairly easily how things can go wrong with some of these high-end guys, to the point where if we're talking about second base as even worse next year, I really would not be surprised.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, one other name, you bring up a good point on like top tier. It's worth noting that that's only three players in terms of Marte, Altuve, Albies. And then it's a bunch that happen, you know, are a couple that happen around pick 100. Matt McClain brings some youth and maybe some upside.
Yeah.
Semien is right next to him. And then it's, again, quite a drop off where you're looking at like Luis Garcia, who's interesting. Bryce Turang, Steve, I know that's a rabbit fade for you. And then we got stuck talking about Xander Bogaerts on our show with Nick a couple weeks ago. And that's very much like you're signing up for the mediocrity.
Yeah.
Same thing we were talking about with catcher. So, Steve, as you're looking at the board, how are you approaching it here?
I think now with the rule changes from a few years ago, eliminating the shifts, with stolen bases becoming more prevalent, that you know, you could hide a Mike Moustakas at second base because you just shifted, you know, your whole infield to the right side. So, you know, Mike Moustakas only had to cover a little bit of ground. You can't do that anymore. So I think it's shifting a little bit more into valuing fielding at second base, which is not something that, you know, tends to the game that we play. That being said, I think this is kind of like a wait and see position, kind of how Chris you're talking about with catcher for me. Like, it's your team's gonna have flaws. I think my flaw is gonna be at second base. You know, I'm not willing to take Ketel Marte in the second round. I know that he had an MVP caliber season, but he was also like a middle round pick that played great on a rate basis but was always hurt for the last 4 years that we were waiting to get back to, you know, that 2019 year. Oh, with the rabbit ball, by the way.
It's so funny how this guy can't stay healthy. Like, we're so strong on you can't stay healthy.
Then he does.
You do it one time, though, and we're like, cool, he's a second-round pick now. Like, because I've been a Ketel Marte guy for years.
He's a great player. He's a great player, yeah.
And, like, you could get him at steep discounts. You know, like, was he going outside of the top 100 last year? Because
somewhere
he
around
couldn't
there.
Stay healthy. And it's, you know, we're probably too certain when we think guys can't stay healthy. I think in this case, we're also moving too far in the opposite direction of saying, all right, he did it once. He's fine now. And it's like, well, no, he's a guy who's had trouble staying healthy, who's in his 30s. It's fairly easy to see how things could go wrong there.
Here's my hot pick of the draft in 2025. Tyler Fitzgerald, who I've been hyping up even ahead of the Willie Adames move. This guy's got the same percentile sprint speed as Ellie De La Cruz. Mm-hmm. He's always had that pull power in his profile to where he went on that 10 homer month homer binge. And right now on roster resource, he is slated for second base. In the past week and a half, his ADP is at 240. I think that this could be one that like surges up draft boards because of the position. I actually don't even think he'll have the eligibility, but he played like 7 or 8 times last season there. And that's one that I think in the grand scheme of things, I'm hoping it doesn't get overtaxed because it's a guy that I liked anyway. And now he's kind of got this huge position opportunity to be like a big fish in a small pond. Steve, were you chiming in, or Chris, go ahead.
I'll point out one other guy who's in a similar range of the draft, Brandon Lau, who for a long time I was hoping, hey, get him out of Tampa Bay. He's never going to play every day. Another guy who can't stay healthy, right? Like he's always missing time. All of a sudden, though, now that they're going to be playing at like Yankee Stadium 3.5, I think we can call it, in Tampa, like they're getting the short porch in right field and they're going to be playing in hot human environment. Like this could be a huge park upgrade for a left-handed hitter in particular. I actually think it might play worse for the right-handed hitters in Tampa because Tampa has had a very short left field, but right field could be a really, really advantageous offensive environment for a guy like Brandon Lau, to the point where I'm kind of hoping the Rays actually do hang on to him despite his exorbitant for the Rays $9 million salary or whatever it is.
Yeah, that's a good name too. I think the Yankees might be linked with him as well. So yeah,
would love that too.
Across the board. Yeah, very interesting. I know, Steve, you've been on Lau in the past as well.
I've always loved his power. He's another guy that has had trouble staying healthy, but you know, hey, if Ketel Marte can do it, Brandon Lau could. I know his back has just been something that's always been concerning, and that's a super hard thing to deal with. But I like it. And Van, in your honor, in the first draft that I did snag Tyler Fitzgerald pretty late. But so
he's an early chalkboard one for me. It might be one I got to fall on the sword.
He's a pretty polarizing guy, and I've seen some takes either way. On him.
I like it, man. Yeah. I feel like he's got that Simeon thing with the pull power that he's going to hide from a lot of people.
It's a good process. I like your thoughts there,
Chris, talk to me about third base. I think we got to make up some time here. This is another one that's a hot position this year, which finally. Talk about third base in terms of the landscape and where you pick or where you see yourself kind of jumping in drafts.
Yeah, one thing I always like to say is don't fight last year's battles. And I feel like that's happened a lot at third base, where like there was a point maybe 4 years ago where it was like, man, third base is really bad and you have to pay up to get Nolan Arenado or whoever it was. And then I think that year a bunch of third basemen had really good years and it was like, oh, third base is a great position again. And then the next year, and so these things tend to come in cycles, and I try not to like play the position scarcity game too much. I do think, you know, they're because of guys who lost third base eligibility, which is actually some pretty high end guys. Ellie De La Cruz, Gunnar Henderson, Vladimir Guerrero were all third base eligible, will all not be third base eligible, at least to start the season. So there might be a bigger gap between Jose Ramirez at number one and whoever is your number two. For me, it's actually Jazz Chisholm, but Austin Riley, Rafael Devers, I think are both are fine second round picks in a 15 team league. I think there is a pretty big gap there. And then after that, I think it's pretty deep, you know, in terms of that, like, I don't know, maybe third tier at third base is pretty deep, in the same way that, like, you know, first base, once you get outside of the top 100 or 150, there's a lot of guys you can talk yourself into. I feel like that is like third base, but around 100. There's a lot of really interesting names.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Royce Lewis, just ones that could go off. Yeah, Steve, what are your thoughts on third base?
I think it's a great position. I think there's it feels how first base sort of felt, you know, when mm-hmm. I first started playing yeah. fantasy like 10, 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Like, there's just a lot of players, a lot of young, exciting players. Like, you know, I could talk myself into Mark Vientos being, you know, a guy,
especially
that,
with Soto there.
Yeah, that yeah, has point. Like an yeah. Austin Riley type progression where he slowly chips away at it at a K rate and a really good lineup. You know, Junior Caminero is arguably one of the most exciting prospects in fantasy. You know, Royce Lewis, you know, talk about a guy, if he could ever stay healthy, looks like, you know, he's had stretches where he was not just like the best third baseman, but he was like the best fantasy player for a few weeks at a time there. So it's an exciting position. I want like two of them, especially in uh-huh. leagues where there's a corner infielder. Even if there's a util, like I'm fine with plugging in. Like, I think there's good enough players that you could have a third baseman and then your third baseman be a util player, just because the position's deep. I know that Ellie and Gunner were both third base eligible mm-hmm. last year, and they both lost that, which kind of mm-hmm. stinks, and is a bit of a hit to the position at the top. But there's still, like, you know, Manny Machado, despite like a slow start, was, you know, amazing from essentially like July 1 on.
And had a very good excuse for struggling.
Yeah,
elbow surgery and wasn't playing third base early on.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so he normally is a slow start, was normally not that mm-hmm. bad. Yeah. But yeah, that's a really good point. So I would expect him to be Manny Machado for the full season, not just, you know, 3.5 months of it. So I think it's a really good position. And, you know, sort of to jump ahead, like, I kind of want to leave the first 3 to 5 rounds with like a first baseman, a third baseman, a shortstop, and an outfielder, and then like maybe one pitcher. That's kind of how I think that's where the best players are, and you only have 4 top picks, right? 5 top picks. Like, mm-hmm. why not spend those on where the best assets are? And third base is one of
them. Well, I mean, that's the segue to shortstop, which is just embarrassment of riches at the top with Witt, Gunner, Ellie, Mookie. And then it just kind of keeps on going where it's like, all right, I can get Lindor, O'Neill Cruz, like, you know, Seager's always coming with a ton of upside. And I think this is one that is probably the most loaded position. Chris, want to hear your thoughts about it. It's also one that has some deeper options as well.
Yeah, this is, however you slice it, whatever your definition of, you know, if it's X of the top 10 or, you know, X of the top 50, whatever it is, like, shortstop is disproportionately represented. And part of that is, like we mentioned, a couple of guys who were eligible at other positions are now only eligible at shortstop. Or in Mookie Betts' case, lost the second base eligibility, which would have been really nice mm-hmm. if he had kept it. Yeah. And now they're talking about him playing only shortstop, which, one, I just think that's a bad idea for the Dodgers. I don't think he has the range or the arm to play shortstop every day. Like, it's mm-hmm. incredible that he's able to play it at all, but it probably
at
should 32. Not be his probably should not be his primary position. So hopefully he gets those 5 games at second base fairly quickly, and we can get him where he's needed, which is second base. But yeah, shortstop, it's deep with superstars. It's deep with interesting, like, middle round names, like, you know, Xavier Edwards, another guy who, one, probably shouldn't be playing shortstop. If you look at the metrics, they are really bad. Probably should be a second baseman. Also, we don't need him at shortstop. He'd be an easy top 10 second baseman. And instead he's like my number 16 shortstop, I think. So like that just tells you, you know, like Mason Wynn, I think can be. I think Mason Wynn could be mm-hmm. like what peak Tim Anderson was, if he decides mm-hmm. to be more aggressive as a base runner, especially. Zach Neto just had a 30-20 season. You know, maybe Dansby Swanson bounces back. Carlos Correa was really good when he was on the field last year. So there's so many things that you can talk yourself into at shortstop, including a bunch of really interesting prospects, like Jordan Lawler is still a prospect. Jacob Wilson, you know, I know it was a little disappointing when he actually played, but still some upside there. It's by far the easiest position to get excited about. If you have 3 or 4 shortstops in your lineup, that's probably not a bad thing, given the guys who have multi-eligibility, your middle infield spot, your utility spot could be a shortstop very easily. It's just by far the best position in fantasy. And what I think that means is I want to try to avoid obvious non-difference makers. And so, like, I look at, like, Anthony Volpe. Maybe there's still some room for growth, but I'm pretty pessimistic about what he is. Ezekiel Tovar, again, maybe there's some room to grow. He had a decent season, but, like, there was no point last year where I was like, man, I really wish I had Ezekiel Tovar. It was just he got to the end of the season and had decent numbers. And so that's what I'm trying to avoid. I'm trying to avoid, like, there are a couple of specialists I'll make an exemption for if, like, I really need speed and Xavier Edwards is there. Okay, I can do that. But for the most part, I want to avoid Jeremy Peña, another guy who's just like, ugh, he's fine. But, you know, it's like he'll finish as a top 15, top 20 shortstop. There will be very few points in the season where you're like, yeah, Jeremy Peña is one of the 15 best shortstops in fantasy. He'll just get there at the end, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's a good point you bring up, too, that there might be an opportunity to kind of drain the pool and stack up here, like grab a Mookie and put him in outfield and then pair it with another short. Steve, when you look at kind of the bevy of names, is there any one or two that, like, you're really circling going into drafts, or do you kind of let it come to you and just say, I want one?
I definitely want, like I was saying on the last point with third base, like, most likely, one of my first two-round picks is going to be a shortstop. Like, if I don't
get... It'd be hard not to.
Yeah. And there was a great article by Brendan Tuma. He has a great Substack. He does work for Underdog Fantasy. Just, like, about the state of the stolen base. And in it, he went on a... he did a great breakdown of, like, these legendary seasons that have occurred, which he, like, qualified as, like, basically above $40 worth of fantasy value over, like, the last 15 years. And, like, 8 of the top 15 have come in, like, the last 2 years with the stolen base rules. And you're going to get that from guys like Ellie. Like, I know that, Van, when we did our mock draft with Nick Pollock and the Pitcherless Pods mock draft, we kind of got a little bit of pushback from the Ellie pick that we had at, like, 4 or 5 overall because... You know, it's the notion is that stolen bases are easy to come by.
Plentiful.
They're plentiful. Yep. However, what Brendan's point was in that article is that now that these legendary seasons and, like, superstar seasons are happening more often with these rules, you kind of need one of those players to have a roster spot of 60, 70 combined homers and steals. And that's going to come from shortstop and then the position we're going to talk about next. It's going to be like Ellie. It's going to be Gunner. It's going to be Bobby Witt. Like, so if you don't have one of those guys in on your team that produces both of those mammoth totals and homers and RBIs from your one roster spot, you're at a disadvantage, and you're going to find that at shortstop, and then you're going to find that at the position that we talk about next.
The one thing I would just say is every draft I've done so far, You reach a point probably around round 10 where, like, it is so easy to find steals. And, like, those steals are going to come with flaws. You know, like, Xavier Edwards just may not hit. You know, like, he might hit the emptiest 265 you've ever seen. Like, that's totally reasonable. It is so much harder to find a power hitter who's not a complete zero everywhere else. That's the one thing I'll say is Ellie... Specifically, Ellie, I think more than the other guys in that group, ties you into a specific type of team throughout your draft that can be difficult to navigate. It's not to say he's not worth that pick. It's just you may hit various points in your draft where it's like, man, I really don't need speed, but the best guy is Bryce Terang. And it's just like having multiple guys like that in your lineup can be really hard to manage, even though Ellie's obviously not a zero in power, but he's a three category player. I think it's fair to say he's just so superlative in the one, but, like, you're going to be at a deficit in RBI and batting average with Ellie De La Cruz as your first pick. It can still, you can make up for it. It can still be worth it, but it does limit your flexibility moving forward in the draft. That's the one thing I would say.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Ellie at, you know, where last year at this time we were talking about, you know, he had these projections for, you know, 450 plate appearances with the projection one of the to bake in the downside. And it's like you had to balance that. And he sort of peaked as like a mid second rounder. I think went a lot of times in the third round, maybe even the fourth around this time last year. So there definitely was some more room for value. And I think he did hit, I would say probably close to his 80th or 90th percentile outcome overall. Like the batting average wasn't even that bad, despite the strikeouts still being above 30%. But yeah, that makes sense. And especially it's not only going to be a first round pick, it's going to be in the first half of the first round in most drafts. So that that's a good point. But I think just, you know, you could kind of pencil in with Ellie, like, I don't know what 20 and 50 is like a downside.
Yeah, I mean,
like
that feels like the floor,
70
yeah.
homers and steals as the floor.
He was weirdly, he was weirdly only on like a 40 steal pace in the second half.
The second half did not run that much.
I think that was
only
probably
a 40 steal pace.
Only, but I think that was probably, we have nothing to
maybe
play
he
for.
Was banged. Who knows?
I'm not worried about Ellie De La Cruz not stealing 50 bases.
And maybe he'll have a little more RBI luck than like over half of them being from his homers themselves. So shortstop, we hit that it's the big one. And Steve, like you said, we get to outfield where there's a ton of value as well. And we'll get to that right after this second ad break. We'll be right back. So Steve, you were talking outfield. Obviously, this is another area where you can load up. I know you've done it in the past on ADP. There's been some drafts that you've grabbed, three rounds out of five. And this year, it looks like we've got seven or eight guys that might go in like a 15-team first round. And a new name in Jackson Chourio, whose ADP is 17. And then you got even the Yordan Alvarez in the middle of the second round, although that's probably DH. You got Acuna back there. I mean, there's a ton of excitement with outfield and then kind of a mighty middle. I would say of all the positions we've talked about so far, the deepest middle tier, which is what you'd expect when it's the deepest position in terms of actual bodies on the field. So, Steve, we'll flip it around this time. Talk to me about kind of what goes through your mind when you're thinking the outfield landscape this year versus years past. And then we'll go to Chris on kind of what tiers we like to attack this year.
Yeah, there was a point maybe two or three years ago where I was like, I was very focused on best player available as like my draft strategy. And there was an early draft where I just ended up with like three outfielders through my first five picks just because like I was like, oh yeah, of course I want, you know, Julio Rodriguez in the second round after like his rookie year or whatever like that. And it's easy to fall down that trap, but I think it's just such a great spot for filling your needs, especially in five outfielder drafts. Like if you want to, like I think that's kind of opposite of what I'm saying, and that there's really good early players, but there's also opportunity in outfield in five outfield drafts or five outfield teams and leagues where it's like, all right, you need steals, draft an outfielder that runs a lot. You need batting average, you know, you could draft like Stephen Kwan if you need that. If you need homers only, there's guys that have that one category. So it's deep, it's talented. I still want a top end one, just because, you know, I feel like it's a position of talent, like shortstop and third base, and I want to leave with one high end one early. But there's also guys that like I love that are breakouts, and you know, one of my favorite players from last year too. I just put in a bullet point on outfield was Riley Green. That's it. That's the bullet point. Mostly because of you, Chris, of just how much you've hyped up Riley over the last few years. Like that guy, like he is just a top player. Like, but he's just a hitter's hitter. And I'll never forget Nick Pollock was talking about it when breaking down pitchers. He's like, you know, certain. He's like, I don't break down, like Nick literally spends every waking second of his day breaking down pitchers, but he's like, I do know hitters that are good because when I'm watching these pitchers, when certain guys are up, they're careful. If they make a mistake, like they look down to the ground because they know that it's not going to be missed. And Riley Green was one of those hitters, and there's plenty of outfielders that are like that. And it seems like, you know, O'Neill Cruz was gifted outfield eligibility at the end of the year. Like there's a lot of guys that are thrown out there that's, you know, with positioning, like you were saying earlier, like some more guys could play outfield than they could in the past. So it's an exciting position, one that I think is probably the most flexible as far as, you know, filling out your team needs, but also like, you know, where you can draft some stars too.
All right, Chris, what's your take on outfield this season? Where are you going to be kind of circling as your tier to jump in and really attack?
You know, it's interesting because we talked about how third base has gone through these periods of like fallow and very, very good. And it feels like outfield the last couple of years. Like, I remember last year, the talking point was outfield stunk. There were like 20 good outfielders, mm-hmm. and then it was just like a wild west. And then you had, you know, even with some down years, like Wyatt Langford not doing what we thought he would, Luis Robert being a big bust, but like, you know, James Wood graduating and Anthony Santander having a breakout mm-hmm. season and Lawrence Butler and Brenton Doyle. Like there's a lot of interesting names, but I think the key thing is last year there were a handful of those guys like Nolan Jones and Josh Lowe, who, I mean, you had to spend like a top 70 pick to get Nolan Jones and Josh Lowe based on their one season breakout. And now Lawrence Butler's starting to get pushed up a little more. I'm not sure exactly where he's ended up. He was like 100 early on.
I loved him there.
You know, 83 now, number 19 outfielder. That's a little Brenton Doyle rich.
Right behind him at
86. Both those guys.
Since December, Butler's up to 73. Oof. So the arrow is getting pricier and pricier.
I don't think I can justify a top 75 pick on Lawrence Butler. There's a lot of risk there still. But I think there's like, at least at the beginning of the draft process, you didn't have to pay those prices. And the other effect of that, though, is, okay, those guys are getting pushed up, but like Anthony Santander just had a 40 homer season. I know we don't know where he's going to play yet, but he's 93 in ADP. Yeah. Riley Green's around 110.
Yeah.
Christian Yelich was a top five player mm-hmm. when he was healthy last year. He's 120. So like it's just a much deeper position than it's been. I think the like 120 to 160 range, and especially I think Dylan Cruz is being overlooked a little bit. I know the production since he turned pro has been not quite what we hoped it would be. You know, it took him a little while to figure it out at AA. He wasn't great at AAA. He was pretty bad in the majors, but I look at the component parts of the skill set. 93rd percentile sprint speed, 12 stolen bases in 31 games in the majors. I think he had 30 plus between the majors and minors last year. Like all of a sudden Dylan Cruz might be a legitimate source of speed. Mm-hmm. Really good swing decisions. I think the plate discipline is going to be there. It's just a question of maximizing the quality of contact, which hasn't been there quite as consistently as you'd like, and hitting the ball in the appropriate areas, mm-hmm. you know, hitting the ball in the air and hard. He hasn't quite done that yet, but I mean, we're talking about one of the most productive college hitters ever, who was a universal top 10 prospect in the world for like 3 years in a row before he was drafted. It feels like an opportunity to buy before the breakout, where I like James Wood. I think he's going to be a super good player. He's 50th. I think his skill set is probably a little more fantasy friendly than Dylan Cruz, although Dylan Cruz's speed is better than I think he got credit for. But like, that's the one where I'll probably get FOMO and draft James Wood once. I'm probably going to draft a lot of Dylan Cruz because I'd rather take that chance at that price. But I think like that number three outfielder range, there's a ton of guys that you can pick from. Parker Meadows,
Peaker Armstrong.
I even like that, like Elia Ramos, super deep as Jung Hoo Lee.
Sure.
That's actually like top 30 projected in terms of like auction value. I think he's being slept on. If you know, he looked better than his stats looked before the injury.
Yeah,
yeah. There's so many.
Cedric Mullins had an awesome second half, and it's like it didn't matter.
Exactly. Price.
You know, Kerry Bonds.
So
there's just I was just criticizing Nolan Jones. He still plays at Coors Field and his ADP is 242. So like that's 150 picks later than he was going at his latest last year. So I'll throw a Nolan Jones out there just to see what happens, you know, when it's that cheap. Like It's just a much deep. Evan Carter. I am shocked at how late Evan Carter's going. 283.
That is such a fall from last year. Yeah.
So, yeah, I think it's a deep position at basically every spot. And I'm excited about outfield, and I was not a year ago.
I love it. I think it's going to be a position that will be fun to shop on the mm-hmm. wire, on the free agents all year long, because it does seem like even like Matt Wallner's out there, like those types yeah. of guys can bring a huge value to your team. And, you know, you almost want a swappable slot just so you can try to catch lightning in a bottle early in the season. So, guys, executive decision. Are we good skipping relief pitcher for this show, since we've been running a little long, and it's everyone's least favorite?
We should never talk about relief pitcher until like 6 days before the season, when you actually know who's going to be closing. Because otherwise, it's like, well, that guy's good, but I don't know if his man like this. It's hard enough to do this job without having to guess what some old guy's going to do.
Yeah. I brought him in the seventh because I felt like
It's hard. Like, relief pitchers would be hard enough to predict when they're throwing 50 or 60 innings a year without having to also guess who Rob Thompson is going to use as his reliever. Like, I'm fine never talking about relief pitcher. It's like when I was doing fantasy football, nobody made me do kicker and defense rankings, so I didn't.
Just skip it.
Nobody told me to do it as part of my job, so I didn't. And that would be, if I was not told to do relief pitcher rankings, I would not.
I love it. I love totally that the only talk we'll have on relief pitcher is how we're not going to talk about relief pitchers. So that means our grand finale here is the all important starting pitcher landscape, which this is a podcast, much like Pitcher List in general, Chris, where we kind of follow the leader. And honestly, it has been a good path in the past few seasons, where it seems like just you can find lightning in a bottle throughout the season, throughout the early months. You know, that year over year, like the parity of the top 25, even the top 50 pitchers, you've been able to get away with not paying up like you used to have to do with the big four, when it was like, you know, Kluber and Sale and Verlander. So we are kind of a fade pitching. In the past, it's been to like the seventh, eighth round. This year, we did look at it and say, okay, it seems like there's quite a honeypot between like pick 50 and pick 80, where we'd love to grab our first one. So that's kind of where we fall. I want to hear your thoughts, big picture, on the landscape for starting pitcher, and kind of where you're feeling your preference on where to attack it.
I'm sorry to keep referencing fantasy football. I know some fantasy baseball people get very defensive and territorial about it, but there are some theories that have gone really mainstream in fantasy football that hasn't quite picked up the same. And I think that this idea of like the RB dead zone has been a huge talking point in fantasy football the past couple of seasons. And, you know, you have like zero RB versus robust RB versus hero RB. And I think historically the data has shown that like a hero RB strategy is probably the appropriate balance between those two things. And that is how I feel about starting pitcher. And I've done a lot of research on, you know, where starting pitchers come from, where starting pitcher busts come from. And it's very similar to running back, because what happens is the guys who are both proven that they're really good, have been aces for more than 1 year, and have proven that they can do the ace workload for more than 1 year, get pushed up way, way high. Not this year, really. The top two pitchers in ADP right now are guys who have done it for 1.5 years in one case, and about 3/4 of a year. And they are by far the most expensive players at the position.
Skeens and Scooble. Yes.
I love Skeens. I think he's amazing. I am not so convinced that he is so far and away better than anyone else at the position that like he's going like top five sometimes. And this is a guy that we've just never seen do the 180 innings. I'm not saying he can't. He just hasn't done it. And that is different than having done it. So he's my number two SP. Please do not say I hate Paul Skeens. I think he's amazing. Tarek Skubal's really good too, and has done it for only a year and a half, but at least we have that half year in 2023 and the full, you know, 190 innings or whatever he did in 2024. I'm just a little bit more confident in that. But to get back to my point, what has historically happened is the guys who are proven multi-year aces get pushed up. Then you start to see like old guys who aren't quite as good or young guys who we think are aces but haven't done it. And that's where you get in trouble. That is historically, and it's the same thing at running back in fantasy football, where it's like, if this guy can keep his efficiency for 250 carries, and it's like, well, yeah, but there's like six guys who can do that, and they're the top six picks in every draft. That's the struggle. And so historically, where pitching has been the best investment is top two or three rounds. Those guys pretty consistently give you 180 plus innings, pretty consistently give you great ratios, tons of volume, everything you want.
A Zach Wheeler type.
Yeah,
or
Zach Wheeler is kind of the most prominent example this year. Then what's really interesting is it basically flattens out immediately to where like rounds three through six or four through six, whatever. They're slightly better bets than seven through nine, but not nearly as much as you would think based on the price. And seven through nine are not that much better than 10 through 12. And so my approach over the past few years, and it's worked out pretty well. I don't know what's happened to my offenses, but my pitching staffs have been pretty good the last few years. And it's been with, I try to go with like not pocket aces. I'm never going to take two first pitchers with my first two picks, but like two in my first five or six. And then I don't touch the position for like eight rounds, 10 rounds. And so I want to get either like, maybe it's Paul Skeens or maybe it's Garrett Crochet, who now is, I think, top five in the month of December at SP. If I'm going to go that route, though, I've got to pair them with a stabilizer like a George Kirby or a Framber Valdez, who like the ceiling's not as high, but I'm pretty confident I know what I'm going to get. I'm going to get 190 innings. I'm going to get good ratios, not elite, not like, oh, my God, this changed my whole team's makeup, but just I can put them in there. They're gonna give me a nice base.
But it does seem like, I mean, even what you were saying, like Kirby or Fromber, or like one that I was talking about was Imanaga next to Kirby. Those are three round differences. So do you like, in terms of your SP2 with that type of build, do you still prefer that pocket that's kind of like 60 to 90 more than the 30 to 50 range?
There are some really good, like 60 to 90 has some really good, like boring volume plays. Like Imanaga,
Bailey Ober.
I don't know if Imanaga counts because he had a little bit of an injury history in Japan. Obviously hasn't, probably won't throw every fifth day. So I think that limits the upside. But like Pablo Lopez, I know it's been frustrating the last couple of years at stretches, but you know, you're going to get the 200 strikeouts. You know, you're going to get a pretty good whip. You know, you're going to, like, he's gone 180 innings three straight years. I feel really confident with that as my number two.
And a stallion.
A stallion, exactly. And it gives you a little, even like Luis Castillo, I'm pretty down on, but 77th as like the 22nd SP, it's hard to argue with that. Yeah. And so I just think, you know, from a team building perspective, what those guys give you is more flexibility to one, punt the position and get your offense in order. You know you're going to have, I mean, all pitchers are volatile. There's a high attrition rate. You don't know anything. There's no such thing as a safe pitcher. But within that, there are some that are safer than others. And it gives you more flexibility to start taking those chances after the first 150 picks, where those guys actually historically are not much worse bets than the pitchers in the 7 through 9 round range.
Yeah, so there's Logan Gilbert, who makes a meteoric rise. That type of thing is becoming less and less uncommon.
It's easier, I think, once you have that base, that really solid foundation, it makes the streaming game easier. It makes the taking a chance on, like, I still like Mackenzie Gore. You know, like when that fastball was 96 plus, he was so good last year. And it's just, can he keep that fastball that in that range? So Spencer Arrighetti, 11 awesome starts, like 12 total disaster starts. I think it gives you a little more flexibility to take those chances on guys where, yeah, the upside, you know what the upside is. And when you post your team on Twitter or Blue Sky and everyone's like, yeah, but your number three SP is pretty rough. And it's like, yeah, but everybody's number three SP is going to be rough. Like that. That's just that's the thing is, I know that attrition is going to screw up everybody's pitching staffs. I would rather take a couple of closer to sure things and then let attrition take its, you know, and look, it's risky, right? Because if those two guys get hurt, you're completely screwed. And like Garrett Cole was supposed to be safe last year. So like it's hard to say, you know, especially at starting pitcher where like the injury rate over a long enough time period is 100%. You know, like within a 5-year span, basically every pitcher is going to get hurt. Exactly. And, and in a 1-year span, probably 45% of them are going to get hurt. I think the two stars and then a bunch of scrubs approach has worked well enough for me in recent years that I'm comfortable building my staff that way.
That's interesting. That's fresh perspective on here as well. I think it is interesting as well to go over and peek at like the auction value and where those tier cliffs are. And there's at least on, you know, this projection model that's up, it has a 5-pack up top and then a $10 value drop. So it goes Skeen, Skubal, DeGrom, which Steve, I know you're in on because of the fact that injuries can hit anybody. And then Chris Sale and Garrett Crochet, as that 5, and then it's a big drop to like Wheeler, Gilbert, Glasnow. But Steve, final thoughts on pitching, and then we'll wrap and let Chris be on his way. But this has been awesome. Steve, if you want to round out with your take on the position landscape.
Yeah, I think, you know, I was molded in, you know, the few small leagues that I played in coming into this game, and then starting to do more industry and more in FBC leagues over the last few years. Like, I've adapted and understood, like, hey, you can't just like wait till round 10 to draft the starting pitcher. That's not doable. Like, and I think Eno Saris has talked about it a bunch, and it was a strategy that worked for him well last year in the main event that he talked about, is like a soft punt on starting pitching, which, you know, maybe it's not two pitchers early, but it was like for him last year, I think it was like George Kirby, then wait till like round 10 or something like that. Mm-hmm. So like have a
Joe Ryan.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. It was like George Kirby, Joe Ryan, and then take guys that you believe in it. Because I think a reason why waiting and why those pockets of SPs are interesting and you could find value there is because starting pitchers, we have so much data that we consume as far as like, you know, velocity and then even just like skill metrics as far as like K rate, swing strike rate, K minus BB. Like it's much more easy to project and find breakouts and find values. Whereas for hitters, like there's so much that needs to go on for things to break right. Right. You know,
sometimes you only need one start.
Yeah.
To know.
Yeah.
Like that,
you don't need much data
in both ways. Like last year, AJ Puck, I liked him a lot as a sleeper. He made one start at the start of the season. I was like, nope, this is not going to happen. Yep. We can drop him. It's fine. When Garrett Crochet.
Yeah. It's like, one start, I'm good. Yep, I'm in. I'm in.
One start is like, oh, no, this guy's got like elite extension and a huge fastball and cutter. Like, this is going to work.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So that's, we get criticized sometimes on FBT for like spending 90% of our time talking about pitching every day. And it's just because one start from like,
it means so much.
Spencer Horwitz went 3-for-4. Well, yeah, that'll happen. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, a pitcher. Exactly. Seeing a 2-mile-per-hour velocity jump or like introducing a new pitch is like, oh no, that's real.
Especially in April, right? Like if you're like Garrett Crochet won your leagues off wires in March, like that, that was when that happened. So yeah, that's kind of why I am of that, you know, and that'll always be part of my, you know, I'm not saying that I don't ever want to learn or change or get better at this because I definitely can. But that's just sort of, you know, just one of my pillars of fantasy philosophy. So,
for sure,
it's just something that I think is, for me, it's the most fun part of the game is finding pitchers like that.
I agree. As an analyst, I love talking about pitching. There are a few things more fulfilling and also frustrating when like I write about a pitcher and then like Nick or Eno Saris writes about the same pitcher and has the same conclusion. Yeah. I'm like, well, that makes me feel smart. also they're better than me at this. Yeah. So, you know,
like how,
why read my yeah,
once in a blue moon you differ and you're like, I'm gonna hold that and like hold firm, and then it works out, and then Nick's always like, but why did you think that? Like, I want to hear your original rationale why you thought Justin Steele would break out. And I'm like, I don't remember, Nick.
Like, I want to bottle that feeling of, you know, when I drafted Jared Jones in like the 18th round in my home league and like, you know, talked about him on a show and hyped him up. Not saying that I was the only one doing that, but those first seven starts where he was just like giving up one hit and striking out 10 guys a game, it's amazing. There's nothing like it. Yeah.
All right. Well, Chris, again, thanks so much for coming on. And for all our listeners, of course, you guys know Chris Towers, but again, on X and on Blue Sky at CP Towers, and the newsletter as well, like he plugged at the top of the show. And you guys can go out and check out all of these individual article breakdowns that go much deeper. It's a really good read. You've got the top 12 in there. You got guys who have moved up this year, moved down this year based on what they did in 2024. So, Chris, it was a privilege, a lot of fun, man. And it's surreal to kind of chatting and doing this in real time when normally we're used to hearing you just on dog walks in the neighborhood. So thanks again so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, guys. It was great.
Thanks again, awesome. Chris. Thanks, guys.
Yep. We'll be in touch next week. For now, thanks for tuning in to episode 163. And thanks for talking baseball with us.
Later.